You are listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, when I was in middle school, we used to play dodgeball in P.E. Dodgeball, the coaches would put us into two separate teams. We'd get those balls, and they would separate us in the gym. And, you know, you try to throw the ball at the other team and hit them to knock them out. And as they did that, they would get us in lines that were far away. But then the coaches who operated as referees would blow a whistle, and you could remove a boundary and move closer, and the game would continue. They'd blow another whistle, and you could remove a boundary and come closer until finally at the very end, there was just a thin line separating these two teams, and you could just really wing a ball at somebody from close proximity. And in the midst of all that, we enjoyed the game, challenging the other team, but where these both teams were alike was when our mutual disdain for the referees. Nobody liked the rules. Nobody liked being forced to stay far off. Nobody liked being hit and called out. You were out. No, it didn't hit me. No, he cheated. No, that's not fair. And we hated being called out. We hated the rules. We chafed against the referees. And yet I'll never forget one day, Coach Atwood was our referee, and he blew the whistle the first time when we were able to remove a boundary and get closer. And he blew the whistle again and removed a boundary, and he blew the whistle again, and finally there was just that thin line between us, and as we just hammered each other with kickballs, I'll never forget, he blew the whistle again. And yet all the boundaries we knew of had been removed, and so we stopped and looked at him confused. And then I'll never forget, he looked at us and he said, "No rules." And then he went into the locker room. And we all stood there stunned for a minute. And then one kid that was holding a kickball just went boom and hit the guy next to him and went, "You're out." And the guy went, "Says who?" And picked up the ball and hit him back. And then suddenly we all realized there's no boundaries. There's no rules. There's nothing. And so then everyone started to die for the ball and fight each other for the ball. And the next thing you knew, seconds later, rather than a game of dodgeball, there was just about 10 or 15 like mountains of piles of middle school bodies. Kids just all diving on a ball and another kid diving on. And there was just this pile of kids and there was no game. And so in the midst of that, it got to be not fun. And so you would watch kids like try to erect a set of rules again. "No way, guys, listen. Hey, everyone back up. No, let's put some lines so we can do this again. Hey, go, no, give them the ball for a second." And everyone would be like, "You're not in charge, forget you." And so the reality was, as we tried to erect these different rules, it never really worked. And so a vast majority just said, "You know what? This just got lame," and they quit. And we sat on the floor until it was time to go to social studies. Because when we lost the rules, we lost the game. Now, why do I say that? Because we're approaching this section on sex. And as we talk about marriage and we talk about sex, there has been a burgeoning movement now of secular books. And I brought three that I read recently, all by women that would describe themselves as liberal feminists. And I don't say that as a pejorative. I just say they wouldn't say they're coming from a scriptural background. I don't know their personal spiritual background. But as they look around the culture, they would say so many advancements in the lives of women have been good and to be celebrated. But they said each of them in the world of sexuality, as we entered the sexual revolution in the 1960s and on, we bought this idea that we need to liberate sexuality from all these boundaries. We need to liberate it from the boundaries of commitment till death do us part to a marriage. We need to liberate it from this assumption that it has some spiritual value, that there's a meaning to it. We need to strip it of any kind of meaning and just say, no, this is just a thing you do. Like you eat food you like, you sleep with who you like. It's just a biological urge, that's it. And therefore, now it's become, we need to remove it from even the boundaries of emotional commitment. I don't have to care about you or have you care about me, that we can separate our emotions and not catch feelings like they're a disease. But rather, we can suppress our emotional life and enjoy our sexual life free from all these boundaries. And yet each of these women, not coming from any kind of religious commitment, as they've surveyed the culture and looked at stats and heard stories and done interviews, each of them have come and said, hey, this removal of boundaries, this meaningless, commitmentless, emotionless sexuality has left us with less. And each of them, if they've listened to the cries of pain of young women who said, you know what? I was told that real freedom sexually was just to sleep around like the most promiscuous of men. It wasn't life-enhancing, it was life-taking. And there's a collective cry of pain in the culture now that's asking the question, how do we get back? Where do we go? How do we erect some kind of structure, not to hold us stifled again, but a structure that's conducive to life? And incidentally, this bottom book, Peggy Ornstein, does the same, but talking about men. Women aren't the only ones who lost in this deal. That the proliferation of pornography in your generation, speaking of millennials and Gen Z, you experienced something no human being has before, that you journeyed through puberty with an avalanche of very explicit sexual images put into your world, and it has completely messed with, now statistically we're seeing, even your desired template, and it's complicated relational scripts in a lot of tragic ways, both for women and for men. I reread Lord of the Flies just recently by William Golding, a 1950s book that is not meant to be a metaphor for sex, but it could be. That these boys are liberated onto an island paradise, and it is paradise meant to be enjoyed and flourishing, and yet as they enter into this paradise where there's suddenly no rules and boundaries, rather than that being full of freedom, that liberation becomes dangerous for them, and it ends, what, with death, murder, strife, and the whole paradise on fire. Until finally an authority structure comes back in, and as they see this British naval officer, what happens? These boys begin to cry, and young Ralph weeps for the loss of innocence and for the darkness in a man's heart. And for many of us, where there's freedoms that are good in our modern society, loosening the act of sex from the boundary of someone committing to you and loving you, of believing that sex isn't just something you do like eat a sandwich, it has a bigger meaning. Trying to remove sexuality from these boundaries has not liberated us, it's cost us more than we want to give. And here's the tough thing, these books were heartbreaking for me to read. I really enjoyed each of them in a way, particularly Louise Perry's book on the case against the sexual revolution. Again, as they look, they say, we've got to walk away from this because this promise of liberty sexually has not really brought us life. And I could quote them all, but rather than quote all these women in the tragedy, I realize many of you know that. It's fascinating. Louise Perry spoke not that long ago to the Oxford Forum, the students at Oxford. And she began her talk by saying, 20 years ago, Jenna Jameson, arguably the most famous porn star in the world, stood in the very spot I'm standing now, and she extolled the virtues of porn and the liberation of sexuality from boundaries, and a unanimous group at Oxford voted to affirm that position of an unbounded sexuality. And yet Louise Perry stood there and said, but now many of us have experienced not liberty, but hurt, that it's cost us something, that we don't like that this liberation of sexuality tends to be just a loss. And she said, I think we're feeling the loss now in this generation. And this entire student group in Oxford voted to agree with her. That 20 years later, a young generation is rising up and saying, hey, freedom is good, but unchecked by certain restraint, it's hurt us, it's cost us, and we weep for the end of innocence and the darkness in a man's heart. So what do we do? Well, I could talk about the tragedies of it for the rest of our time, but I don't want to do that. I want to do something else. I want to go back to the Word of God and say, hey, I have no interest in trying to return to the 1950s or something. I wasn't there, and I'm not trying to get you to Victorian England either. I don't care. The question is, what's God's intent? If the Bible presents sexuality and love and marriage and romance as a gift, how did God intend for that gift to be used? And so I want to go to the Song of Solomon. And rather than lament the tragic, broken things, I want to celebrate what's beautiful and good. We're going to look in Song of Solomon chapter 3 at a young couple in love. And we're going to see the joy of their wedding day. And then we're going to see them enjoy their wedding night. And it is hot. Then we're going to turn the sprinklers on and send you out of here, right? Amen? Just kidding. Maybe. But I remember the first time I ever heard this preached as a young man, I wept listening to it. And it wasn't because the pastor was wagging his finger or shaming anyone. He was just showing us the beauty of what was possible. And for me, already as a young man growing up in a sexually broken day with already the bits of a sexually broken past, I saw him extol the beauties of what could be, and my heart ached. I want that. And my hope is that no one leaves here shamed, but maybe you leave here with a little bit of hope of what could be and what was meant to be. So chapter 3, the woman speaks, and she's going to tell us how she feels on her wedding day. So in chapter 3, verse 6, she says, what or who? What is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. Litter is like a sedan chair that he's being carried, that men would come for their brides. And she knows he is coming with his entourage, and his entourage is of sufficient size that she can see the dust rising in the distance, and her heart begins to leap. Behold, the coming of Solomon. And yet what's interesting, look at how she describes it. She doesn't say, hey, look, they're kicking up dust. She says, like a column of smoke in the wilderness. That's specific. That's imagery grabbed directly from the book of Exodus. That in Exodus, when the people of God were in bondage in Egypt, God comes as a lover of his people, and he sets them free. The column of smoke in the wilderness was God's presence with his people as he led them out of bondage through the wilderness into the land of promise where they could flourish and have life. And she pictures her wedding day as something holy, that marriage is a holy institution given by God. It's a gift. And then she looks at this man, and she says, you're like God in certain ways. That as God came for his people to use his strength to serve them, to set them free, you're coming for me, and this is a godly man. She looks and says, this guy is holy in the ways a man is meant to be. He is like God. This is a good man who fears the Lord. But then also notice she doesn't just say that it's like a cloud of smoke. She says it's like incense, fragrant powders of the merchant. She says, man, it's like the finest of imported perfumes. Incense was used in the temple. And it's fascinating. The Old Testament books that, you know, usually don't read Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and the like, where Bible reading plans go to die. If you find yourself there, you'll find sections where God cares a lot about what the temple smells like. He says, when people come into my house, I want the perfume made in a certain way. I want constant burning incense because I want them to think about their covenant with me and smell something sweet. I want them to know that being bound together with me is not exploitative. They're not rules that crush you. Being bound together with me actually liberates you and sets you free. I want them to know a covenant with me has the smell of sweetness. And she looks at this man and she doesn't see the shackles of marriage. She looks and says, this man is holy. He loves God. This institution is holy. This binding together in this covenant has the sweetness of an intimacy God made me for. She says, this man is godly, and what we're about to do is godly. That God cares about this. God cares about your love life. God is not the enemy of your love life. He's not the enemy of your sex life. He created these things, and he wants to create an environment where they can flourish. And here this woman is excited. Here comes my man. And notice how she perceives him. She says, around him are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and experts in war, each with his sword at his thigh against terrors by night. David, Solomon's dad, was the warrior king, and he had warriors that surrounded him, the mighty men who were the best of the best, and they had a nickname. They were called the 30. And yet here, look what Solomon has surrounding him. He has the 60. It's doubled. And these guys aren't just battle trained, they're battle ready. Their sword is on their thigh, and they're not just phoning it in from 9 to 5. They're there to protect even from the terrors of the night. How does this woman feel with this man? She feels safe. She feels secure. He is strong, but it's not an exploitative strength. It's a strength that makes me feel like I am cared for. And it's fascinating. Over and over again in surveys of women, there's a desire for that sense of commitment in which I feel safe. In the article Sexual Economics, social psychologists Roy Baumeister and Kathleen Vo say that on average, men want sex or variety in sex more than women. And on average, women want commitment and security to know that they'll be treasured. And that's important. That's how a woman's meant to feel. Now, again, in the past, in agrarian and industrial societies, the physical strength of men was paramount in a working world. That's what put men out working in the fields, women often caring for children at home. As men were physically bigger, and it's still the case, that if you look around biologically, on average, by and large, the vast majority of men are significantly stronger than the vast majority of women. That means less now in the work world. And that's probably a good thing, that physical strength was necessary in an agrarian society, necessary in an industrial society, but now we live in a technological age where women don't need to feel confined to certain roles. There's freedom to enter the workplace and stand right up alongside men and work, and there's a lot there that's been good. And yet, where the physical strength of men still has a value is in the sexual realm. Particularly, men, on average, by and large, still have within themselves the ability to very much hurt women physically. What's the scariest thing you can run into in the night? It's not a raccoon. It's not even a snake or a lion or a leopard. It's a man without moral restraint. That there's a power to men, and that power can be a terrifying thing. And women are right to have a moral intuition that warns them against men who have power without godly restraint. But here she looks at this man and she sees he is strong, but that strength is used to make me feel safe. And gentlemen, that's how you want a woman to feel. I'm not here to use you. I'm not here to exploit you. I'm not trying to denigrate your emotions and use your body. I care about you. You want her to feel safe. Now, with that said, I'm not saying that every dude's got to be jacked, right? And so I know some of you are like, man, I got to improve my deadlift. Well, maybe, I don't know. And not all of you are necessarily physically built that way. And that's really fine. Ecclesiastes 7:9 says, wisdom gives strength to the wise man. More than 10 rulers there was a city. That there's different kinds of strength. That you can have a strength of competence that you know how to handle money, or strength of competence that you know how to manage a home in a way that allows for flourishing. That's what she wants. And that's what you can provide. I want that from my financial advisors. I don't care how much he can bench, but if I'm gonna give him my money, I want that money to be safe. I wanna feel safe. So I want him to be strong against the terrors of the night. As I give to him something of value for me, I wanna know he's worthy of my trust. And here this woman wants to know, this man, is he worthy of my trust? And in a dangerous world, he comes with a special forces caravan. This dude is set. And notice what else in verse 9. King Solomon made himself a carriage of wood of Lebanon. That's the best quality lumber he could get. He made its posts of silver and its back of gold. Those are precious metals. Its seat is of purple. That's the color of royalty. That purple dye came from the murex shellfish, which was very hard to obtain, and thus purple is very expensive. And here it says, this couch that he's coming to receive her on is made of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Notice what she does there. She's saying every detail is taken care of with the finest of quality, that this man is holy, this man is strong, and this man is complete. This is a good picture, not just of their wedding, but of their courtship. He's not cutting corners. He's not slumping and phoning it in. That he cares about every detail in the way that these details communicate that I value you and what you value. It's interesting, you know, I ministered for years at Texas A&M, and I remember going to a wedding once of this couple that she was not just an Aggie, Texas A&M Aggie, she was a Texan and an Aggie. So I remember showing up at their wedding, and all of her bridesmaids were wearing Aggie maroon and holding the yellow rose of Texas. And I was like, wow, that's commitment. And then I went to the reception and their cakes were built like the Aggie bonfire, right? And we would celebrate. I'm like, that is commitment. And then I remember as they walked down the aisle, it was to the Aggie war hymn. That I'm like, you guys have not missed a detail. That every single level you want to say, we value this. And this guy, in every detail, in a way that matters, he wants to show you I care. And I am going to not phone in the details. I want to show you I care with completeness. I remember for me, when I realized I want to marry Donna, she had told me that it was valuable to her to think that her husband would one day talk to her dad and her mom before asking her to marry her. That was important to her, and it was important to me. So I remember as I wanted to get married to her, I was in Dallas doing finals in seminary, and I went through all this drama to buy a ring. That's a whole other story to get those details right. But I had the ring, and I was like, dude, I could get engaged tomorrow. And I'm like, let's go. And I wanted to do it, and then I realized, no, she really wanted this, and I didn't want to be like, oh, I figured I'd call your dad later. I was like, no, that mattered to her. So I called her dad and was like, hey, can I come talk to you? He lived in Oklahoma, a few hours north. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, great, I want to come by tomorrow. And then I called her mom, who was further south in Texas, and I was like, hey, can I come talk to you this week? And she was like, actually, we're leaving tomorrow to go to Europe. We're going to be gone for months. And I was like, when are you leaving? She's like, tomorrow morning. I'm like, can I drive you to the airport? She said, yes. I'm like, all right. Called her dad back, like, hey, what are you doing? Like, now-ish? Can I come by? And so I finished my last final, jumped in the car, drove several hours north to Oklahoma, brought gifts for her dad and showed him my financial statements. Like, look, I want to marry your daughter. I want to take care of her. Like, she's capable. She has a great job. She can take care of herself. But, you know, if anything happens, I just want you to know I'm competent to care for your daughter. And he was like, you don't have to tell me all that. I'm like, yeah, I do. Because as her parents, you're concerned for her safety and concerned for her flourishing. And I want you to know I value her safety and I value her flourishing. So I want to show you I've got resources that I'm accumulating to help her be all she's meant to be under God. That's what I want to do. And I feel like it values matters for you to know that. And he was like, well, then you can marry my daughter. Like, huzzah, you know? And so they were like, you want to stay for dinner? I'm like, nope, I got to go. And so I got in the car and drove through the night, watched the set and arise. And I remember as it rose in Texas, I went to go pick up her parents. They're like, you ready to go to the airport? I'm like, yeah. It was about an hour drive to the airport. The whole drive, I'm like, don't kill the potential in-laws. Don't kill the potential in-laws. I'm driving, I'm like, I'm so tired. And yet I pushed through it to talk to them about marrying their daughter. And they said yes, so that the next day I could show up. And as I hit a knee, told Donna, I dotted every I and crossed every T because I knew it would communicate to you love. And I want to do that. I had a young man, he was still in college and she was in college. He wanted to marry this girl and he told me, man, I want to marry this girl. And so I just want to go talk to her dad and tell him like, I love her and I'm going to live on love. And I was like, let me tell you something, man. Like, I talked to a lot of dads that when their baby girl's in college and some guy wants to whisk them away, they're worried that she won't get to accomplish all she wants to in her education or get the jobs. They're worried that you and your foolish desire to mate will hamstring her future. I said, so you got to cut that off and talk to her parents to let them know you're interested in her flourishing. I said, let me tell you a great way to do that. Go meet with a financial advisor and get your money right. And show her parents, hey, I know how much it costs for her to be in school, for her to accomplish this and that before she goes out and gets a job. I know what it'll cost for us to move through these college years. And I want you to know I've made preparations for that so that she doesn't miss a beat in becoming all she's meant to be. I said, don't come to him and say, I'll live on love. He ain't gonna wanna hear that. Say, I'm gonna live on love, and love forced me to Microsoft Excel, and I did the work to be complete. And this man doesn't cut corners physically, emotionally, sexually. He covers all the bases so that on the final day, he is a prize. And you look at verse 11. Go out, O daughters of Zion, look upon King Solomon with a crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. She says, ladies, look at that. That's the kind of guy you want, that he is holy, he fears the Lord, that he is strong, but he uses it for good, and he is safe, you can trust him. And guys, look at him, this is the day of his great joy, that he gets the opportunity to love this woman. Now in chapter 4, we skip the reception and head straight to the wedding night, right? They go back to the hotel. And where the woman was dreaming of the wedding, the guy is excited about the wedding night, which is often the case, not always, but often. So now he begins to sing. And the poem we get starts in chapter 4, verse 1. And as they are alone finally together, he says, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. That word behold is hene in Greek. It means look or whoa. That finally, with all the chaos away from them, he pauses, lets the world stop, and he looks at his bride and says, wow, you're beautiful. He does what Adam did with Eve the first time he saw her. Wow. And he compliments her and begins to praise her. And gentlemen, I want you to notice where he starts. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. So she still has on her veil. But he peers through it and he starts with her eyes. And he says, they're doves. That's the imagery of gentleness, of softness. Maybe he's watching her lashes bat up and down. But the encounter is not rough. The imagery is tender. There's a sweetness to it. And then he moves to her hair. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Let me explain. Gilead was the most beautiful part of that world you can imagine. Green, lush hills that surrounded the Jabbok River. And if you've never watched a flock or a herd or a pride descend down a mountainside, I remember watching some mountain goats descend down a mountain in Colorado. The way they can flow in unison down steep terrain is almost magical. It's otherworldly. And here he says, your hair is like a flock of, like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. What's happened here is she's let down her hair. And this was a very sensuous thing in that day. Women did not do that for just anyone. They reserved that moment for their husband. That we know now that I'm my beloved's and he is mine. And so she lets loose her hair and his knees get weak. And then he moves to her teeth in verse 2. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from their washing. That means they are white and they are clean. So brush your teeth, ladies, right? All of which bear twins. That means they are straight. And none among them have lost its young. That means they are there, right? Which we laugh at, but in a day before modern dentistry and orthodontics, this is all a real plus, okay? This is awesome. And then in verse 3, he moves to her lips. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. He praises the redness of her lips, the desirability of her mouth. And then he says, your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. He compliments her complexion. Pomegranates have a reddish orange or a pinkish hue. He says, you have a youthful glow to your skin. Then in verse 4, he says, your neck is like a tower of David, built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors, which again, probably describes or needs some description. The idea of a tower combines the ideas of strength and dignity. That he's saying there's something majestic about you. Now, you'll hear men sometimes speak of military implements with female names, and that's not connoting possession. It's connoting superior craftsmanship. And he looks at her and says, there's something regal about your strength. I love the way Louise Perry said it in her book. She said, there's a big difference between a man desiring you and him esteeming you. That if a man just desires you sexually but doesn't respect you, you get out of there. And here you see this man say, I respect you. There's something dignified about you. Proverbs 31 says of the ideal wife that she's clothed in dignity, that's how he sees her. You are not meant to be used and discarded. Don't disregard your moral intuition. If a guy doesn't value your heart and your mind, then you be careful. You get out of there. Wait for someone who will treat you that way. It's fascinating. I watched She-Hulk recently. And there's an episode of She-Hulk, you know, she becomes this green monster that in some ways is like this idealized physical woman. There's this episode where she wants a date. And so she gets on a dating app and she says, I guess what she wants, but in a sense, almost what she thinks people want, like very thinly veiled sexual innuendo in her invitation online. And she just gets a host of men responding and she picks one and they sleep together. And then the next day, the scene opens with her in the kitchen, but she's back down to her sort of more diminutive human form, the less sex goddess version of herself. But she's happy, and she's making him breakfast. And he walks out the door, and she's like, I made breakfast. And he was like, yeah, I'm out of here. And he leaves. And it's meant to be a comedy, and she breaks the fourth wall. So in that moment, she looks out at the camera, and she makes a joke like, oh, yeah, hot doctors are a cliche. But she holds a glimpse at the camera for a second longer. There's no music and there's no laugh track. And it just feels sad. She wanted him to stay. And it's not wrong to want him to stay. Then the next episode, she meets a guy she really likes and they date without introducing sexuality. And you watch her turn him away at the door as they cultivate an emotional love. And then finally, after they cultivate an emotional love, they sleep together. And then you watch her with an even bigger smile text, I can't stop smiling. And then she never hears from him again. And as she's processing it with a room full of friends, they asked her, did you text him afterwards? And they said, yeah. And they were like, what'd you say? And she said, I told him I couldn't stop smiling. And collectively, they all groan, oh, you're not supposed to do that. And she goes, I'm sorry. And as I'm watching that, I'm like, what's the cultural script there? That the modern woman is not supposed to desire someone to stay and is not supposed to desire someone to care, but she does and she can't hide it. And it's not wrong, they're wrong. That statistically over and over again, you see women desire sex, yes, but sex with someone who will be there and will love you And this is the environment God created it for. That in commitment and in care, I give all of you, or all of me, to you. Not just my body, but my heart and mind to someone who wants it all. And here this man sees her, and she has dignity, and he has value. Make sure a man treats you like that. But guys, I want you to see something too. Stop here. Men, do you see what's happening? We're four verses in, and what's he done? He's complimented her eyes, and her hair, and her teeth, and her lips, and her neck. We're four verses in, and he's still on her face. He won't touch her until verse 11. He talks to her. That sex is not just physical. It's also emotional. And we know this biologically, that the act of sex reduces hormones that are meant to reinforce bonding emotionally, that we are built that way. You're not built to create a violent divide between your physical life and your emotional life. They go together always because they're meant to go together. You're not catching feelings like they're out there from a disease. They're meant to rise up as you give all of you to someone. And here as this man meets with her, he's not just meeting physically, he meets her there emotionally, and he speaks to her and uses words. He tells her what he sees, and then he'll tell her later how he feels. And that's how sex is supposed to be. And even within marriage, men, let me just say, it does get challenging. Oftentimes guys, when they do fall in love with a girl, that we get good at being poets and writing words like, you're like a flock of goats. No, that feels bad. All right, and we kind of work on that to woo her and win her. And then as soon as we woo her and win her and we get married, we just become roommates. And suddenly we're concerned with our career and we forget cultivating intimacy and romance. And then years later, when the divorce papers come, we say we fell out of love. You don't fall out of love in the same way a fire doesn't suddenly fall out of fire. Fire burns out, you kindle it to keep the flames fresh. Love is the same way. And the way you kindle the affections of a dynamic sexual life in marriage is emotionally. And so guys, we have to find ways, married men, to put the remote down, dig deep, and tell women how we feel. And for not all men, but for some men, that's very hard to do. But we have to try in the name of love. It's interesting, Christine Emba from the Washington Post, in her book, Rethinking Sex, she says, scholars have found over and over that emotional factors tend to be particularly relevant for women's sexual response. And then she quotes statistics about why the vast majority of women do not experience orgasm in hookups because they don't know or trust or love that person, that version of sexuality doesn't lead to fully their life flourishing. And so men, we have to find a way to connect again, speaking how I feel, what I see, that emotions and physicality go together. Now, ladies, I want you to know that for guys, when you get married, that's hard for them to do. Not all guys, but many, it's hard to put words to how you feel, and many of them will not do a good job. You'd be lucky to be compared to a flock of goats. And I just want you to say, be gentle with their stumbling attempts. Shanti Feldham says this in her research of men. She said, most men want to be romantic, but they're haunted by past failures and the fear they'll disappoint you. And that's true. So be gentle. Speaking of being gentle, he moves from this military imagery as he continues down her body. In verse 5, he switches the images. He says, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies. I love the way one commentator says it. He says, quote, moving down her body, he next focuses on her breasts, objects of male erotic interest that need no explanation. You're like, all right. Well, there's a little explanation here in the text. He calls them fawns. That leads to an interesting question. Well, how are they fawn-like? It could be youthfulness, but there's also a picture of beauty and grace that's connected to gazelles, but there's a sense of tenderness too. I love the way Tommy Nelson, when I first heard him teach this, said, he said, how do you approach a deer in the wild? You don't run up and go, hey, fawns, that's not how it works. You are gentle, you move slow. And let me say that sexuality here is emotional, he talks, and it's gentle, he moves slow. That, again, it's fascinating. Over and over again in the research about women's sexual desires, what they will say they want when interviewed about sex, they will often use words like love, attention, self-esteem, affection, commitment, and feelings of emotional union. That doesn't mean women don't enjoy the physical aspects of sex, but it means it's intimately intertwined with how they feel emotionally, right? That they want to feel I'm being valued and cared for. It's not just jumping into a sexual act. It's connecting at a heart level. This is challenging because on average, men tend to have a higher desire for sex and variety in sex than women. If you look at the bell curves, they tend to not match. It's fascinating. Louise Perry, in an interview, talks about the bell curves of sexuality of men and women are skewed. Men wanting more sex and more variety on average than women. And she said the first sexual revolution was when ancient Rome would use women sexually. The big revolution was Christianity that called men to monogamous marriage to one woman. It pulled men back to care for what women were interested in. She said, now what you see is we've returned to a sexual world that's much more like Rome. And what we've done is told women, now have sex like a man, which what we mean by like a man is usually like the worst of men that divorce emotions and commitment from sex. And so she says, the first one is this revolution of men being called to be gentle. And yet it's fascinating, ladies, on average, men typically desire sex more than women. If you just look at the numbers, Mark Rednaris does extensive research on the sexuality of particularly young people. And in one survey, I love this. He asked the question, if you had masturbated in the last 24 hours, 30% of single men said yes. 26% said they did not want to answer that question, which I just love that. One out of four was like, no comment. Women, by contrast, only 8% said they had masturbated in the last hour. 21%, or last 24 hours, 21% said they didn't want to answer the question. So again, still statistically significant, and yet almost a 3-to-1 from those who admitted it, right? When asked about the usage of pornography, 86% of men said they look at it on at least once a month, while 69% of women indicated no porn use at all. Now that means 30% of women do, and that's a statistically significant number that I've encountered in our ministry, several that struggle with it, and I'm not shaming you from it. You were inundated with it before you were looking. And yet if you look at men, it's a much higher rate that are drawn to the physical reaction of looking at sex on a screen. And the tragedy of that is though, interestingly, in survey after survey, where people say, we know porn isn't real sex, we know it's fake, the way it tends to dehumanize women, see them as disembodied parts, even though they separate it, it has leaked back into the sexual realities of a lot of young people. And particularly heartbreaking for me was reading in Christine Emba's book that 13% of sexually active girls between the age of 14 and 17 had experienced being choked in an intimate encounter. And the BBC survey said they found the same year found 38% of women have experienced choking during consensual sex. When did choking someone during sex become the norm for 38%? It's introduced through the proliferation of pornography. And I want to challenge us men, you be gentle, you be kind. That when women talk about sex, it's love and attention and self-esteem and affection, that you make sure you be gentle. Your wedding night is not the time to enact your porn-infused fantasies. You can hurt her emotionally and physically. You be gentle, you go slow. Some of the best advice I got on the eve of our marriage, I went to a mentor and just asked him the question, like, what am I doing? What am I doing? And I remember he said, you make it about her. You be just attentive to, is she comfortable? Does she feel safe? Is she relaxed? You make it about her. He said, I promise you, you'll have fun. Almost statistically guaranteed. But you want to make sure she does as well. So you go slow, you follow her, right? I will not unpack great detail about Donna and I's wedding night. But I will say this, I took his advice. And I was just watching her, and I noticed when we got to the hotel, she's nervous. There's a lot of pressure put on this moment, and particularly focused on the female body, and I just wanted her to feel relaxed. I was like, hey, I noticed you didn't eat anything during the reception. It was just such an onslaught of humanity. I said, are you hungry? She was like, I'm starving. I'm like, let's order a pizza. And I said, what else do you want to do? And she's like, I want to get out of this dress, but I kind of want to take a bath. And I was like, well, let's do that. And then she got a little embarrassed, but she said, you know, I'd always imagined my husband undoing my hair. I said, then let's just do that. And so we took a minute and, well, we took several minutes. There was all kinds of clips in there and I'd never really done this. I'm like, but we got there and it was great. But we just knew over time, hey, how do we enjoy this dance of our sexual life together? And we talk, it's emotional, and you go slow. And gentlemen, notice as he's talked to her, he now breaks off his description of her body at her breast and he begins to declare his intentions in verse 6. He says, until the day breathes and the shadow flees. That's poetry for all night long. I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. Now, if you're in your Bible in the map section going, I don't see a mountain of myrrh anywhere in Israel. Yeah, it's not there. He's talking about her breasts. She called them the mountains of cleavage in the previous chapter, inviting him to them, but it wasn't time yet. Now he was like, yeah, that's where I'm going. She had had a pouch of myrrh nestled between her breasts in the previous passage, and he was like, that pouch of me trading places, like, that's where I want to go. I want to go to the mountains of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. And that's not bad. You're meant to enjoy the physical aspects of sex. Proverbs 5 says, a lovely deer, a graceful doe, speaking of the wife of your youth, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. I love that verse. I preached it in my preaching class in seminary because I just love that it wasn't just kind of communicating what's essential for the act of procreation. Thus and therefore, you don't enjoy the breasts of the wife of your youth in order to further the species. You do that because it's fun. And that's the word of God telling you you're meant to enjoy the sexual encounter. It's meant to be fun. And he is passionate and lets her know how he feels. And so in verse 7, he says, you are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. He sweeps up all his compliments in the positive and negative. He says, you're altogether lovely. There's no flaw. It's the imagery of when you would go to the temple in the Old Testament, you would offer a sacrifice before the Lord and you made sure it was an animal with no blemish or defect. And he takes that common imagery in the culture and he says, when I look at you, there is no blemish and no defect. Now, does she feel that way? No. You saw in chapter 1, she's self-conscious about her skin, that she didn't take care of it the way she wanted. And all women, even the most confident, will have some insecurity about their body. The pressure on female sexuality and female body is intense in the culture. And yet when he looks at her, he says to her, you are altogether lovely. And then he issues an invitation in verse 8. Come with me from Lebanon. My bride, come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Senir and Hermon, from the den of lions, from the mountain of leopards. She's not literally in some other town. He's picturing the furthest away place north he can imagine and the highest of elevations. What he's talking about now is as he's complimenting her beauty from a distance, he's starting to feel the physical distance. But rather than pounce across it, he starts to feel the distance and he says, will you cross the distance to me? Come away from the crowds, come away from the people, come away from the den of lions, come away from the terrors of the world and come into the safe place of my embrace. He compliments her and then he calls her, will you be with me? And he tells her how he feels in verse 9. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You've captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. He moves from what he sees to how he feels. He says, I'm your prisoner. That the smallest detail of your jewelry has completely arrested the king. That's how he tells her he feels. One translation says, you have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes. He calls her my sister. That's not weird, it's not incest. Back then, your family was the closest people to you emotionally. And what he's saying here is, I'm not just attracted to you physically, I care about you emotionally. You're family to me. But as he steps beyond that, he says, you're family to me, but when I look at your beauty, my heart skips a beat. My heart races. I am your prisoner. I am completely overwhelmed. He's like Adam when he sees Eve. He's like, whoa, you are bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. You are like me, but so different from me, but meant to be with me. He is overwhelmed by her appearance. Ladies, let me encourage you. There's versions of preaching of modesty that are not particularly helpful and are shaming. And I remember years ago, however, being at a mall and seeing this image of a woman, she was in a very small amount of lingerie on all fours, looking lustily at the camera. And the look was not saying, "Would you like to have a glass of tea?" It was a look of desire. And I looked at it because it was about 15 feet high and 20 feet across. It took up an entire wall in the mall. And as I saw that image, I thought, it's not wrong for her to be in that outfit and to have that look on her face. It's not wrong. It's actually good. God celebrates physical beauty and sexual attraction. God celebrates it. I was like, but she's not supposed to do it for me. Like, I'm not her. She's not mine. And then I look around the mall and there's all these old men and kids. And I'm like, and I don't know that that looks for these guys either. That you should be looking at some guy that way that wants not just your body parts, but your heart and your mind too. You want a guy that doesn't just want to use you. You want a guy that says, I want to commit all of me to all of you. I am captivated by you. You want this guy that his heart beats fast for you. And so wait for that guy. Wait for that outfit. And then when you get there, put it on and give him a heart attack. That's verse 9. Anyway, verse 10. She's closer now, and he moves from what he sees to what he smells and what he tastes. He says, how beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils, than any spice. He compares her to the luxurious spices from the balsam tree is the language he uses. That's what the queen of Sheba in Egypt brought to Solomon. It's what Esther used in the kingdom of Palestine. He says, the greatest scents that the world has to offer pale in comparison to the scent of your body to me. Then he says in verse 11, your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. He says, your taste is sweet. And he uses the words of honey from the comb and then honey from fruit and vegetables. He's using this idea from the promised land. That all through the Bible, the land God was leading his bride, his people to, was called the land of milk and honey. And that meant it's abundance and abundance of life. And milk and honey are also the subjects that nourish you and are sweet to your taste that require no death. Nothing dies to provide milk or honey. And so you have this beauty of nourishment and delight that has no sorrow added to it. And that's a beautiful picture of sex and God's intent. That it's nourishing for you. It's life-giving you. It doesn't feel demeaning or demoralizing or shaming. It feels enhancing. It's nourishing to the soul, not just enjoyable for the body. You are milk and you are honey. You are the promised land to me. This is so much better than saying your body is a wonderland. No offense to John Mayer fans, but saying your body is like an amusement park. That's what he's saying, filled with rides and games of chance. Well, that's wonderfully romantic. But this guy is looking at the promised land and saying, your mouth is my promised land. That's pretty good. And as he says that to her, notice where he says that milk and honey is located, under your tongue. So they're kissing now in a sensual way, which I just want to encourage you, be careful with this. Kissing like this is biologically meant to lead you someplace. You be careful to give your body away from someone who's not worthy of your trust. He says, this fragrance of your garment is like the fragrance of Lebanon. And then he begins to speak as he journeys down her body. He compares it to a garden and to a fountain. But garden, I want to be clear, is not like some vegetables out in the back. He is using park like the way they use it in France. It's not a lawn with a picnic bench in France. When they say a park, they're talking about acres of trees and flowers and pools. And here in this Ecclesiastes 2, Solomon's vineyards, fruit trees, pools of water are in his garden. And so here he's speaking, as is often the case in this letter, of her body as this vineyard. But now as he moves down her body, he arrives at what he calls here her locked garden, a sealed spring. It's the imagery of inaccessibility. And I think there are connotations here of virginity. He says in verse 12, a garden locked is my sister, my bride, a spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with a tree of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, and with all choice spices. The word orchard in Hebrew is the word pardes. It comes from Persian, paradisa, where we get the word paradise. As he moves down to her hips, he says, that is paradise. And in verse 15, he says, a garden fountain, a well of living water, flowing streams from Lebanon. He gives this imagery of life. Obviously, because that is the place where life is born and comes to life from a woman. But he's talking about her sexuality as a pool that's refreshing and life-giving. And yet I want you to notice, he says, the garden is locked. And what he's saying there is, I am not going to force myself on this woman sexually. He has told her what he sees and complimented her. He's told her how he feels, what she does to him. He's told her his intent, that he desires her. But he will not cross the boundary of her sexuality. It is hers to give. It's interesting, Louise Perry, in her book, she challenges at the end. She says, for the practically minded feminist, we need to deter men from CAD mode. And by CAD, she meant someone that just kind of uses and disposes of women. And again, it's not all women's responsibility to make men behave better, but she's just saying the reality is, as a culture, we need to disincentivize the using of women for sexual enjoyment. She says our current sexual culture does not discourage that activity. So in order to change the incentive structure, we need a technology that discourages short-term nature of male sexual behavior. One that protects the economic interests of mothers, creates a stable environment for the raising of children. And then she says, we have that technology. Even if it's old and clunky and prone to periodic failure, it's called monogamous marriage. And it's fascinating, not leaping from the Bible or a religious commitment. She says the safest place to enjoy the gift of sexuality is within a monogamous marriage. Statistically, as she meets with men and women, she says this is where sexuality flourishes for human beings. And yet it's here in this place where you wait to give it all away to someone you can trust that this text celebrates. And you see with this man, he has demonstrated his love with restraint. And often in our culture now, those are not equated, but there is a real love to say, I will restrain my natural impulse out of love for you. And he does not cross the boundary, he waits. Now, as soon as I say that, I know I'm already over time. I apologize. I'll go quicker. You will make it to lunch. But I want to pause here and say, I remember years ago, I had a friend call me, and she was approaching her wedding. And she called me in some degree of emotional distress because she said to me, you know, my boyfriend and I, she said, we're not religious per se, and we felt no compulsion to save ourselves for marriage sexually. So we've been living together and having sex for quite a while, but he finally proposed, we're about to get married, and she says, and as I'm approaching my wedding day, I'm just feeling kind of sad. She said, I'm feeling a sense of loss around it, and my friends keep telling me not to feel that way, to stop feeling that way. Oh, it's just wedding jitters, it doesn't matter, don't do that. And she was like, but I'm calling you because I know you're a Christian and I know that you're probably gonna be the contrary opinion. So she's like, so talk to me about that. I said, hey, look, God created men and women and he gave us the gift of sex. And yet in the Bible, he puts restraint around it, not to hurt us. He says restrain that natural sexual impulse until it can be completely donated to a person who wants all of you emotionally and physically and spiritually and socially committed together in covenant. Then you donate all of you physically. That's how God designed it, that sex is good like a fire. Fires are good hemmed in by a fireplace. They give warmth and life, but outside of it, they can do damage and hurt. And I said, for you, you moved sex outside of this boundary of marriage. And yes, now as you approach marriage, that restraint is supposed to increase anticipation. That if someone is longing to consummate physically, you're meant to feel all this anticipation and all this excitement. So your wedding night is this brand new explosion of a passion finally released. I said, and you are feeling loss because there is a loss, because it won't feel that way for you. And she said, it'll feel like business as usual. And I was like, well, maybe. I said, so you're not crazy for feeling that loss. You feel like there's a loss because there's a real loss. But then let me tell you something. For those of you who are like, Ben, you just said this is about virginity. I understand there's not a lot of virgins in this room. What I said to her is what the gospel says to all of us. We start with the truth. We start with God's standard. And all of us have fallen short of the glory of God. So we can grieve where we're not what we're meant to be. But the Bible doesn't end there with grief, and it certainly doesn't end in shame. It starts there. That as God looks at us and says, hey, we've all landed in a place we don't want to be in. For many of us, sexually, say, man, I've done things, been a part of things I didn't necessarily see, it's beneficial now. It's fascinating. One lady wrote a, I'm blanking on her name, Bethany something. She wrote an article about her regret of her sexual past. That she used to write articles for Playboy, and now she's sitting here saying, hey, I didn't have any religious moral constraint to my sexuality, but now I realize I've experienced a loss and I mourn that. And yet in that mourning for us, if that's you, I want you to know God does not distance from you. He moves towards you. And what I told this young woman is, hey, yeah, you can mourn the loss there, but that does not doom you to a second-rate marriage. It doesn't even doom you to a second-rate wedding night, that you can mourn the loss, but where we confess, which means agree with God that I don't like the way this went, when we confess, he rushes in with mercy. He rushes in with grace. He brings in restoration. That's our gospel. Out of the grave comes life. Out of death comes hope and a future. That God can bless your wedding night and your marriage and your sex life. You're not too far gone. You're not a second-rate citizen. You don't need to hold your head in shame. That God loves to bless people so we can grieve the loss, but celebrate a God who's too good to let loss be the end of our story. That we believe in a God of grace. So let me tell you, you are not too far gone. So I hope nobody in here leaves with a sense of shame about the brokenness of your sexual past. The gospel of grace is too good for that. And yet here in this moment, this couple waited. And in that waitment, there's all this anticipation. He subordinates his physical desire, restrains it for the sake of this woman. And finally, in this moment, he has told her what he wants, what he desires, but he waits. And then she responds to him. And in verse 16, she says to her husband, or excuse me, not to him, she just speaks out, "Awake, O north wind, come, O south wind, blow upon my garden and let its spices flow." The garden of her body is now open to him. He's demonstrated commitment financially, physically, emotionally, and now physically she invites him in. She says, "May my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits." Dang. One commentator wrote, "The man responds as we would expect him in the light of the woman's invitation." Like, yeah, I bet he did. It's pretty awesome. And they enjoy it without a hint of shame. And that's great. That's how it's meant to be. And so in chapter 5, verse 1, the man speaks and he says, I came to my garden. My sister, my bride, I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. I love that because she's invited him in, come into your garden. And the next verse says, I came into my garden. It's past tense. How much time elapsed between those two verses? It's hard to say, right? Commentators don't really know. There's not a hint. It could have been 5 minutes, 15, maybe, I don't know, an hour. It's hard to say. However, I want you to notice, he doesn't say, I hit that, I got it. He doesn't depersonalize her body parts. That's something I particularly hate about modern music. You are not a collection of body parts to use. He says, I came to my garden, my bride, my sister. He says, you're mine. I am my beloved's and he is mine. That's what this book says. I'm not using you, I want you. I give all of me to you, and you give all of me to me. And that's how it's meant to be. It's meant to be nourishing and life-giving, like wandering in a garden of delight. And what's great at the end is somebody else speaks. And at the very end, it's a bit of a debate of who is this. Some people think it's the chorus of friendship, because it says, eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers. That you have a community around them that has supported them. And now they tell them, enjoy. And many ancient cultures used to do this. You can look in some Native American traditions that a couple would consummate their marriage in a teepee in the center of the village. And when they did it, everyone would beat on the side of the teepee going, woo, all right, like, I don't know, it might be hard to quote poetry in that moment. Like, you're like a hawk of, can you just stop, please? I'm trying to, I don't know. But there were other ancient cultures where you would go away into a separate chamber during the reception. And everyone would wait, eat cake, kind of visit, and then you'd come back out, and they would all go, yeah, and celebrate, right? And you'd high-five all your friends because you consummated that marriage. And so here, some people think that's her friends. They said, we've watched your love, and you've done it right, and so enjoy it. They don't have to slink off in the corner. They don't have to hide. This isn't anything, there's no shame added to it. Enjoy, drink deeply, get drunk on love is what they say. Because this is a good gift of God meant for you to enjoy. Some people say that's for friends. Some people think this is God speaking. Because again, God, all through the Bible, celebrates sex and emotional intimacy as a gift meant to be enjoyed. It's a good gift from God. Evil creates nothing. Evil is a parasite that takes something good and distorts it. Your sexual desire is not evil. So whenever you see something evil in the culture, you have to go, what's good and what's the distortion? Your desire for respect and love is good. Your desire for sex is good. So much of the modern application has distorted what God has demonstrably said is to be enjoyed. So what I'm hoping to do today is to remove the distortion and say, is there a scriptural possibility for our sexuality? A mutual love that includes dignity and commitment to one another and the enjoyment of this garden of delight God's given us. I hope so, and I believe that, and I believe it's possible for you. No matter what's happened in your past, nobody is too far gone. And let me close with that. There's a story Jesus told. Jesus one day, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, was sitting down, and the sinners, is what the text said, sat around him. And some of the religious institution came, and they began to fold their arms and humph at a Jesus that would sit around with sinners. And so Jesus tells a story. And he tells the story of a dad and a son coming to his dad and saying, I'm sick of your boundaries, I'm sick of your rules, give me the money and I'm out of here. And the son takes his possessions and goes to a far off country, and he says he spent it all on riotous living, which means complete abandon to every sensual desire. And after he had eliminated all the rules of his father's house and enjoyed sensuality, he found himself in the mud. And he realized, I got duped by this world. Desires distorted left me empty. And as he sat in the emptiness and the mud, he said, I want to go home. But then he got worried that his dad would reject him, that who would take him back as soiled as he is? But he didn't want to stay where he was anymore. And so as he slowly tramped his way back to his father's house, he's rehearsing in the story Jesus told. I'll tell my dad I can sleep on the floor, I'll sleep in the barn, maybe I can work for him. If I work as a slave, maybe one day he'll look at me again. And then Jesus switches the imagery and says, and then the father sees him, his wayward, violated, used up son. And the father sees him. And while he is still a long way off, the father runs and embraces him and kisses him. And the son tries to give the speech, I'm sorry, I made a mess of things. He's like, hey, kill the fatted calf, throw a party. My son is here and I love him. And Jesus tells that story to the people who felt broken because of the decisions. And he wanted them to know, here is God's heart for you. It is not to cast you off. Your father's heart is to run after you. I don't know an adult human who doesn't have broken sexual history. And if you look in the Old Testament, whenever the people of God abandon him, which is often, there is always, without exception, a broken sexual element. Nobody comes to God with clean hands. And Jesus' bride was not pristine, the church. We all come broken. We all come short of the glory of God. We all fall short of this standard. And yet we have a God of grace who says, I'm running for you and embracing you and kissing you and drawing you home, not binding you up in restrictive rules, but giving you an environment where your desires can flourish, that like the bride of Christ, you can be all that you're meant to be. So you don't agree with some of what I said, that's totally fine. I hope you'll keep coming back. We can talk about it later. You feel this and go, man, I've fallen short. You don't lose hope. God loves a redemption story. Our whole story is a redemption story. So you don't lose hope. But we have a God we can trust with the longings of our heart. And let's do it now.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast.